KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1.
Hello, Houston. Live from the KPFT studios, it's the Houston Hour with Houston historian and TV's Mr. McKinney and Heidi Vaughn of Heidi Vaughn Fine Art. Now, sit back and relax as we bring you an hour of all things arts, entertainment, history, and Houston happenings. Here's Mr. McKinney.
And how are you? It is Friday, May 26th, and it's Mr. McKinney here coming to you on the KPFT Houston airwaves with my awesome co-host, Heidi Vaughn with Heidi Vaughn Fine Arts. Say hello, Heidi.
Hello, Houston, and hello, Mr. McKinney.
I am so excited. It is Memorial Day weekend coming up, folks, and we have with us, I know, really, so celebrating our veterans, honoring our folks that have paid the ultimate sacrifice to keep us safe here in America, and we really do appreciate David Ritz coming on the show because he's not only a veteran of the Vietnam War, he's also somebody who has a strong KPFT connection, so I'm so excited to finally get David Ritz on the show because he's actually hilarious. A lot of fun, great energy, but great history about Houston. He's our history guest, and we have with us on the art side, rounding out National Photographic Month. Who do we have on the show?
Dr. Zavia Carner. She has a great new book she'll be talking to us about.
So we'll learn about that, connected to Photo Fest, and so much more. And by the way, Heidi, what do we have for the arts calendar?
I think I'm going to recommend the world premiere of the Catastrophic Theater's new play. It's called A Maroon's Guide to Time and Space by Candace DeMezza. Do you remember who said, "You're such a maroon"?
What a maroon.
I think it's Bugs Bunny from Looney Tunes, right?
That's right. So this is a show about...
They're a little loony over at Catastrophic Theater.
They're a lot loony.
They love to be loony.
They are. It's a play about quantum mechanics and using our imagination to liberate ourselves from the confines of space and time. It sounds really good. And I would recommend, since it's Memorial Day weekend, why not consider a visit to Buffalo Soldiers National Museum, which is over on Caroline Street. They are dedicated to exploring and displaying the stories and contributions of African Americans in the military by way of performing and visual arts, educational programming, and really great exhibitions.
Oh, that's a great idea. And it's in that beautiful 1925 Alfred C. Finn design building, the old Houston Light Guard Armory building. So treat of architecture history, but also the history of the veterans that have fought in so many wars over at the Buffalo Soldier Museum. Well, Heidi, thank you so much for those recommendations. That's going to be great. Well, we shouldn't...
Well, I think we're winding down our pledge month, aren't we?
You know, you're so right. There she is. Heidi Vaughn's mentioning once again, we are rounding out our pledge. This is the last weekend, folks. This is it. On Sunday, we end it. This is our last show for Pledge Drive. So if you've been listening to the show the last 4 weeks now, you know that from May 4th to May 28th now, we've been nonstop asking folks to give and contribute to KPFT because it matters. If you don't like these fund drives, folks, if you're tired of hearing them, well, guess what? The best way to get rid of them is to contribute.
And please remember to mention the Houston Hour.
That is so important. As
Heidi mentioned, we get full credit if you do.
And boy, we need it because we've actually not reached our goal for this entire month, this pledge drive. And it's not because people don't appreciate what we do. I don't think that. I think it's a lot of it. People just don't make that final step to go ahead and give. Hit that button, give. There's a Houston History Bus package for $75. You can ride the bus with a 1.5 hour VIP tour of the Medical Center Museum District. Yeah. In Herman Park area, we meet over at the station at 4504 Caroline Street.
Wow.
It's an hour and a half tour of the area. Plus, you get a VIP tour of inside the actual studios, our brand new home at 4504 Caroline Street. You can also give the brick project too. There's these memory bricks that are available for a $25 sustaining contribution and an $80 monthly contribution as well for an 8x8 brick. So twice that size. Those are opportunities that are available in our courtyard areas you first walk in. So folks, go to kpft.org, give in any amount to the Houston Hour and honor the Houston Hour. Any amount you can give helps us reach our goal. And I can tell you now, we had an $1,800 goal and we're not even halfway there yet. So that's, we need your help. That's all we can say, okay? So please, please, please help us out. Well, Heidi, we shouldn't waste any more time. These folks love our show. We should get started with our very first guest.
Thank you, Mr. McKinney. I am very proud to introduce our guest, Dr. Zavia Carner. She's a visual sociologist and the author of a new book called Making a Scene, How Visionary Individuals Created an International Photography Scene in Houston, Texas. Zavia, welcome to the Houston Hour.
Oh, thanks, Heidi. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I was so thrilled to see your book. I didn't know that it was in the making until our mutual friend, Bryn Larson, who's real involved with photography here in Houston, gave me a copy of your book as a gift. And you got to tell me, how long have you been working on this?
Oh, my gosh. I'm kind of embarrassed to say it took me about 10 years to do the whole book.
And that doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's so thoroughly researched, and we'll get into all of that. But let's start by getting into a little bit about your background. Where are you from?
Oh, that's a long answer. I'll try to make it short, but my dad was in aerospace, so I lived 21 places before I was 18.
Holy cow.
So I'm from west of the Mississippi.
Okay, wow. There you go.
But Houston is the place I've lived the absolute longest.
I could say the same thing. And how did you get here?
I was offered a job at the University of Houston in the sociology department, and I came and I've stayed.
And how long have you been there?
Oh my goodness, about 22 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And tell our listeners, what is a visual sociologist?
Oh, great question. Well, sociologists do social research, and you're probably familiar with surveys and interviews, but visual sociologists use their camera and or study images that are already existing. So instead of or in addition to narrative, we take pictures or we take videos and use that to study whatever the typical, whatever we're studying. And so that's in a nutshell what we do.
You know, it's interesting as I am an art gallery and I'm an art collector and an art appraiser and I love art, but my favorite... I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. My favorite thing to read in the New York Times on Sunday is the first thing I read is not the art section. It's actually what they call the style section. Yeah. And I always say it's been so inappropriately named. It should be called like sociology or something like that, because it is a compilation of so many other things, but it is definitely the category that I gravitate to. So you read that section too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
To kind of see different perspectives.
And it's not just art. It's not just theater or, you know, it's weddings, it's trends, it's words that people are using now. It's all kinds of things. And I used to love Bill Cunningham's pictures. That's visual sociology.
Yes.
Tell our listeners who that was.
Oh, he's a wonderful man that used to wear a blue jacket and ride around on a bicycle in New York City and take pictures of people on the street dressed to the nines.
Yeah, he just liked the way they looked, took their picture. I've seen, there's at least two documentaries about him because I've seen them. I own them both on DVD because I'm old school. But every now and then someone wouldn't know who he was and would have some haughty reaction to him wanting to take their picture. But in general, most people were delighted to be recognized for how they looked.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's a long history of street photography. And he just had a special focus and a way of kind of capturing that specific element of social life.
So are you a photographer yourself?
I have done photography, but I'm more of a social photographer in a sense. I have an iPhone. You know that?
Were you taking pictures before you had an iPhone?
I was. I actually, the first job, a career I ever contemplated was to be a photojournalist. And I did all the high school things.
Me too.
Know. Yeah.
Me too. And working in the dark room?
Absolutely.
How fun was
magic.
That? Mm-hmm.
Magic. Mm-hmm. Yes. My father took me. We lived on Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands. And they had a service center where they had a dark room you could use. And my father was starting to learn to develop film. And he took me. I must have been 9 years old when I developed my first photo.
And it's magic.
It is.
It magically,
and you never forget that first time.
Yeah. And the way that you can manipulate it a little bit.
Even more so now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even more so now.
It's fabulous. Yeah, it's fascinating. Infinitely fascinating.
I actually have an undergraduate degree in journalism. I guess I've got a radio show. It makes some sense. It
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I had this idea that I was going to be a photojournalist and that I would never get married and I would just travel the world documenting, you know. It didn't go down that way, but I did travel the world, but not as a photojournalist, as a mom. But I always had a camera with me. Yeah. Before there were cameras on phones, I documented my children's life abroad. And they're my favorite possessions I own. So this book is gorgeous.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the cover. I think the cover of a book is really important because do we want to pick it up, you know, based on what it looks like? And it's got this great title, Making a Scene. And then this is clearly in the Washington Avenue Arts District, which is this in?
That was one of the biennials of Photo Fest.
Is this in Spring Street?
Yeah, it's where they are now. It was an opening night.
And it's packed.
Yes. And as per usual.
As per usual. As per usual. I think for me, one of my main memories of the pandemic was being at PhotoFest when we were all going, is this a big deal in 2020? And then, of course, PhotoFest got shut down in 2020.
Right.
But we all made it to like one event before that happened. So why is photography important?
In general or in Houston?
Both.
Both. Oh, okay. Well, I think it's important because it's a document of what has been. It's a way also that we communicate with each other now. So it's the past that we have present. If we have the object, it becomes a precious object. Oh my gosh, that would take the whole half hour if I keep waxing poetic about photography. And in Houston, I think it's kind of this fabulous Houston story that some people thought this was a good idea and made this amazing thing happen here.
Yeah, and I think a huge part of it is, of course, Ann Tucker, who I had the fortune to meet when I was in graduate school and get to do some of that really cool behind-the-scenes stuff that you get to do when you're in graduate school in a city like ours where you get to go to the Museum of Fine Arts, where she had a very long career. And from my understanding, she's kind of the one credited with calling photography art and collecting it very early and elevating the form to belong in a museum.
I would say that's absolutely the case in Houston, but there were other museums that were collecting photography. And Anne had the good fortune, or smarts, to actually study and work with the three biggest names in photography before she got to Houston. So she was well...
And who were those?
That would be Beaumont Newhall, who is credited as writing the first history of photography.
Okay, saw that in your book.
And then Nathan Lyons, that she studied with in Rochester. He started the visual studies workshop. And then, I'm blanking on his name, which is unforgivable. He was the photography curator at MoMA.
Mm, we'll think of it.
Somebody will have to read the book. It's in the book, and I spelled it right and everything.
We'll think of it while we're having the conversation.
But so she had worked with all three of these. She had her book, The Women's Eye, was already published, and she had curated her first major show at MoMA before she came to Houston. So this is the mid-70s, and here we have this photo curator coming with all these connections and all this experience, and she lands in Houston. What a great good fortune for us.
Weren't we lucky? And I know you have that the Dumanils are in the book. What were they doing with photography?
They were one of the first in Houston to collect photography, but it's also because of them that we had the very first university class in art photography, and that's Jeff Winningham.
Mm-hmm.
And he was teaching at St. Thomas when the Menils were benefactors there, and then when they moved everything to Rice, Jeff went there and started the media center. So they really started the education of photography as an art here in Houston.
And I'll go on to say that he has had an unprecedented run at Rice University. When
Absolutely.
He told me how long he'd been there, I said, that's not possible. You're not old enough to have been there 50 years. But apparently he just doesn't look it.
No, he doesn't. I think photography keeps you young.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it, the creative impulse. Well, the other thing about Jeff when he came and the Menils is they gave him no budget and just said, you can do what you want for the first 5 years. And
how awesome.
I know. When does that happen in the art world? And then Rice had to take over the budget responsibilities after the first 5 years. But the first 5 years, he did a lot. Kind of amazing. But that really started to build interest and community around photography.
And then talk about the book. What gave you the idea that we needed this book?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I started participating in the photo community here in about 2005, 2006-ish. And it was full bloom. It was wonderful. It was fun. There was so much going on. And so I just kind of was enjoying it for a while. And then all of a sudden, Ann Tucker started talking about maybe retiring as soon as she finished her war photography show.
Mm, what a show.
Oh, it was fabulous. I hope everybody saw it. And if they didn't, get the catalog. It's
amazing. We have. And a catalog doesn't begin to. We've got it here on the shelf. It's a tome. It's a hefty, hefty hardcover book that's not easy to look at, but really tells an amazing story.
So important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Wendy and Fred were thinking of hiring Stephen Evans about that time, and we're moving a little bit off of the day-to-day of PhotoFest. And mm-hmm. I thought, if somebody doesn't capture this now, we're going to lose the oral history. And so I happened to be in Perpignan in the south of France, which is Visa pour la Image, which is a festival of photojournalism. And Anne was being honored for war photography. And so at dinner, she was just kind of musing, you know, I'm thinking about retiring and I don't know what my next project would be. And I said, I have an idea. And that's kind of where we started talking about it. And Anne was really, she was not only the first person to really make things happen in Houston, but she was also where I started the story, was interviewing her several times. She was very patient.
And tell our listeners, when did PhotoFest start?
PhotoFest was incorporated in 1983, and then they had their first biennial in 1986, right in the middle of the oil bust. Can you imagine starting a nonprofit in the middle of, but they did.
They did. And what is PhotoFest?
PhotoFest is so many things right now, but it started out with the idea of being the first and also the largest photo festival in the United States.
Because this is Texas.
Because this is Texas, you got to do everything big.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they did. And, you know, from the very first biennial, they had international coverage for all the things that they did. So their media stack of press is impressive by itself. But basically, they brought curators here and other photo professionals that would look at photographers' portfolios and
that's called a portfolio review, and that is so important to photographers. So basically what you do is you bring a body of work that you present in a portfolio to people who are in a position to give you very good feedback. And what often results is it's expensive to do it, but it often results in a show or a book or an exhibition or something. So it's really worth doing.
Or sales.
Or sales.
A number of people actually have started their collection buying from photographers at PhotoFest.
Uh-huh.
There's stories of, I'm not going to name names at this point, but people buying things right off the portfolio review table, people making enough money to go home, to, you know, they spent everything to be here. So they make their return trip and of course, get opportunities. The number of curatorial shows and book offers, et cetera, has been really, I wonder if Wendy and Fred ever counted how many opportunities. It's probably uncountable.
It would be really interesting to think about. And these are opportunities from all over the world.
Exactly.
So my gallery participates in PhotoFest every year, and we get special signage. There's signage all over town. I don't know how many participating venues there were last year. I know in 2020, I think there were 63, and I think in 2022, there were more than that.
Yeah.
And we all get our special signage that goes in front of our venue, and then sometimes we even get coach buses pulling up full of collectors, and they could be from anywhere in the world, and they just love coming here to just take it all in. It runs for how long? It's more than a month?
It depends. I mean, different years are different things. Originally, it started as a month of photography. And I think this last time, it was just less than a month, maybe 3 weeks, because it got moved to the fall. It's usually in the spring. But yay, next biennial is going to be in the spring again.
We were showing Hillebrand Maxman, and they had
fabulous work.
Yes, we adore them. And they had things at four venues. They had a show here electrically. They had a show at the Silos where they had an exhibition and a performance. And then they were part of the reconfigured show that got canceled. And then that name has just slipped my mind. African Cosmologies.
Yeah.
But it's a really fun number of weeks and just a great opportunity. Each PhotoFest has a theme, and not all the work is directly related to it, but much of it is. It's just spectacular, really and truly.
It is. And even from the very beginning, Wendy and Fred and Petra Bentler, who also helped start PhotoFest, had a very international perspective. So they wanted to bring work to Houston that Houston hadn't seen, but also by bringing the world to Houston, it meant that local artists got a lot of exposure as well and could really maximize their involvement with PhotoFest.
And there's a wonderful book that comes out every year, and being in that is really pretty amazing. And I know it's a great reference tool for people. And it's just a wonderful community here in Houston. We have a number of friends of the Houston Hour that have been on, in addition to Jeff and, of course, Fraser King and Bryn Larson and so many others who are really bringing such great photography to Houston right now.
Absolutely. We're still very lucky, in a sense.
So what are you doing at U of H?
I am the chair of the sociology department, so I have an administrative hat that I wear there.
Are you teaching classes?
And I also run our internship program. Oh. So students that want to figure out how to use sociology in their career gives them an exposure to.
So what kind of internships do they have?
A lot of nonprofits that need research or help with marketing. Or some of our students want to do more hands-on, so they work with also nonprofits that have different service programs. So they've helped with GED training, they've helped with citizenship drives. I have one that's helping with the probate court right now. So
wow,
it's kind of all over. As many opportunities as I can find, I usually have a student that's interested in.
It may come as a surprise I'm talking about probate all the time because I work with estates. I'm a credential fine art appraiser, and one of my main clients is estates. And when people have inventories of art that they need valued for estate taxes,
yes.
also write the charitable donations of works of art to the Museum of Fine Arts and the Menil and U of H. Recently, art was donated to the School of Social Work, for example. Other things at U of H as well, Rice, Moody Center, all of it.
Wow.
We're real involved with all of that. So
it's cool. So you wear many hats too.
I do. So talk about the process of making a book. How does that happen?
Oh my goodness. Slowly and painstakingly.
How many people did you interview?
Over 40, and many of them multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
I spent hours in the archives at the museum, which was fascinating. I got to read Ann Tucker's correspondence from the 70s, all the famous photographers that wrote to her.
Isn't that amazing? You know, were you in the archives when the archives closed and moved?
Well, I started before with the original archivist that put it together, and then it closed, and I had to beg to get into their storage facility.
Because they were opening the kindle. And there was a lot of change going on at the Museum of Fine Arts. So I did my thesis before that. And
smart.
What was fun for me was the archivist.
Lorraine Davis? Can't remember her last
Stewart.
Name. Yes, but she was lovely.
She was
wonderful. And she knew everything about
the art. She'd been there from the start. And Lorraine told me I was the only person who had looked at the information that I looked at. And that was my thesis was on the education program at the Museum of Fine Arts at Mid-Century, which was the patrons of that were Harris and Carol Masterson.
Yes.
And so I looked at their family photo albums. I mean, I looked at all their correspondence. My thesis compared the program at the Museum of Fine Arts to the one at MoMA. And the bridge between the two was the educational theories of Dr. John Dewey from Harvard University, whose idea was about art as experience. Mm-hmm. And it's very cool being in archives and researching this stuff. And I had one of the pictures in my thesis. The de Menils had sponsored all the exhibitions, but they were involved always in education. But one of them, there was a live baby elephant in the Museum of Fine Arts for an exhibition. I think, and I profiled five of the important shows at Mid-Century for children at that museum. But archive work is fun.
It's great fun. I loved it. And I spent time at the Menil Archives as well. Mm. Oh, it was fabulous. And you learn so much about the organization in a way, just the way the archive is organized. Like at the Menils, all the numbers of the photography acquisition start with F because in French, photo starts with an F. You know,
as
so there's
Photo Fest, I should add, for our listeners who are Googling that and can't find it.
Oh, good point. Yes. Yeah.
FOTOFEST.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what did you, can you compare the different archives, how they were different? Or?
Well, the museum archive is huge.
Mm-hmm.
The Menil archive is deep, shall we say, in a sense. And they have hidden gems that I was introduced to, but if I wanted to write three more books, they've got materials from different people that have given their whole personal archive. So there's so much fascinating. I'm not from Houston, so I find all of this history just kind of fascinating.
Well,
all the stories.
We do too, and I'm not from here. And Pete Gershon, who we've interviewed on the show, and we love his books, he's not from here. And I think sometimes it takes an outsider. I wrote books when I lived abroad. I think sometimes it takes an outsider to come in and say, hey, this is really interesting. I'm going to talk about it. And then local people are amazed, like, oh my gosh, we just took it for granted.
Well, and I will say that all the important people that I talk about in the book came from elsewhere.
Oh, is that right?
You know, Houston has these big pull kind of factors. And then people come and find a tabla rasa and
they
have
stay.
A great idea, and people rise and support them.
Now that you mention that, I'm just running through my mind who those people are. And that's right.
Yeah.
They all moved here. So I know Mr. McKinney loves native Houstonians.
Oh,
and we have lots and lots of them on the show.
Or longtime Houstonians, but, people that live for a while.
But also, yeah, so many people are not from here. And I always tell people it's easy to live here because you don't have to be from here. So many people are from other places.
Well, and I love this book. It's an example of really a great resource for people doing further research too, not just with the photography scene, also just a bunch of important Houstonians in here. I've got the pleasure of serving as the president of the board of the Friends of the Texas Room at the Julia Addison Library at the HMRC, and we've got a collection of many things at the HMRC, including old maps and blueprints, but our photography collection is really, really special. And we've acquired recently the K. Marvin's collection through the family, which is a big deal. And it's right now being scanned and digitized. It'll be a long time process, folks. I know people are still antsy to get images there, but a lot of it is about the funding and how do we get that done correctly the way that we need to. But I love your book because in chapter two, it starts out with really bringing photography, art, and culture to Houston. You talk about the diamond years in Houston. Talk about some maybe early photographers that, from the history standpoint, that just are or two. You know, we know Calvin Wheat and we know Schuller, and we mentioned the Marvin's family. Let's talk about
very
that a little
important.
Bit. Yeah, because you got to interview some.
If I can move back to what you just said about the library,
yes.
Because
archives.
You have the very first piece
that's
of
right.
art, a replica, that was bought by the women's group that started the museum, and it's still there. It's a replica of the Venus de Milo.
I wrote about this in my thesis.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Then you know. Yes. Okay. I just love the story that this is
tell
what
us,
these
us,
women are thinking. This is the pinnacle of art, that our first piece to buy. And they order it from Paris, and it arrives, and they want to put it in the high school.
San Jacinto High School.
And
a replica of the Venus de Milo.
In all her naked glory. And it didn't go over too well. So that's why it ended up in the library. But it's still there. It's still beautiful.
It's still there. You'll see pictures of brides in front of it.
Yeah.
So the original collection of the Museum of Fine Arts was all replicas.
Yes, because it was all about educating the students. They wanted to bring culture and start in the elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And they eventually got to where they were doing what they called grading of photos. So like second grade would get Spanish work and the third grade would get French. And, you know, so they had this whole idea of kind of organizing your path through great works of art, as it were. And then at some point they decided, and there's a great quote in the book, I'm going to kind of mess it up a little bit. The president of the Art League, which is different than the current Art League, but the one that started the museum, said, okay, we've taken care of the kids, now we're going after the adults. And that's when they started raising money to have a museum. And our museum is the very first museum building in the state of Texas.
Isn't that amazing?
1924.
That's right. And William Ward Watkin Design Building, too, very well-known architect here in Houston. Came to Rice University to supervise the construction and stayed. So we're blessed. It's such a great space. And we don't look at that building as much as we used to because we enter from a different angle from the you know, the side.
Yeah, the back used to be the front.
I love the original front.
Me too.
I take my students there when I used to teach sociology of art. Maybe I'll do that again someday when I'm not chair. But I love showing them where you can see the little bits of the old museum. The old building there. If you look above the temporary walls, you can still see the molding around the top. Yeah.
Yeah, and you can see pictures of very antique cars in front of what was the front of it back in the day.
Yeah.
But the opening was just spectacular. It was very well attended. I don't remember the numbers, but I think it was in the thousands of people went to that opening.
I think they turned away 1,000 people, the article said. It was well attended, one and all. Yeah.
Yeah. No. So, but what about photography from earlier like that?
Oh, yes, thank you.
Well, the earliest known photograph that we have here in Houston is an 1856 photo from the 300 block of Main, and it's the oldest one that we have. And it's highly possible, photography going back maybe 20, 30 years prior to that in Europe, for example, that there could be an image earlier than that. But I like to remind Houstonians out there, if you're antiquing or going to garage sales, you never know when you might come across a photo of old Houston. So once again, the oldest known photograph that we have in our collection, just in general in Houston as an historian, is the 1856 300 block of Main. So always encourage people to check it out, because if you find a photo like that, it might be the magic one.
Oh, absolutely. And is that photo at the library?
It's either U of H's library or it might be at the HMRC. I think it's actually at the HMRC. I can look and see, but I just know that that's the oldest one that we have. So I like to remind people, and there was 1856 is the oldest one that we have. So if you find something out there earlier, listeners, grab it. It's worth millions.
Well, I was going to say that photography didn't, you know, get started until much before that. So mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it
about 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of time at it all.
And you Houston's know, had to 1836. Move. So when we were found back, so there could be a photograph. I believe it's the 1820s in Europe. So there could be a photograph of early Houston. All we have is etchings and drawings of it, but nothing photographic until 1856. Let's remind folks. Well, we are now getting close to being out of time, but let listeners know where they can get a hold of you, your social media handles, your website, where can they get our email address? Where can listeners get a hold of you if they want more information about what you do?
Oh, well, thank you. I think the easiest place is to go to my website, which is Tracy Zavia Carner, all three names, .com.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for joining us on the Houston Hour with Mr. McKinney and Heidi Vaughn. We're going to break for some measures and come back with more of the Houston Hour on 90.1 EBFT.
In the Tiber, there sits a boat, gently dipping its bow. Trim and tidy and built to float. Pretty little picture. Now, put a boy on the starboard side.
Hey, Houston, how are you? It's Mr. McKinney coming to you during the break, reminding you about the show we have on Friday, June 2nd at 6 p.m. right here on 90.1 KPFT. We have with us, kicking off Pride Month, Alton Delaney. He's an accomplished artist, but he's also the curator of public art at the Houston Airport System, and we're going to talk about all things art with Alton Delaney. He's our arts guest on Friday the 2nd. Also with us, speaking of history, for the history side, we have with us J.D. Doyle. He's no stranger to KPFT audience members that have shown here for many, many years, and he is somebody who has the LGBT Music and History Archives and a radio show for many years, like I said also. He's the founder of the J.D. Doyle Archives.org, so you'll learn about all things about the LGBTQ plus community as we kick off Pride Month on the Houston Hour with Mr. McKinney and Heidi Vaughn. So don't miss out. Helping us kick it off Friday, June 2nd, right here at 6 o'clock on 90.1 KPFT.
You're listening to the Houston Hour on 90.1 FM KPFT, a Pacifica radio station. And now, back to the show.
This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, Viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, 0600, what's the O stand for? Oh my God, it's early. Speaking of early, how about that Cro-Magnon Marty Drywood? Thank you, Marty, for silky smooth sound. Make me sound like Peggy Lee.
And we're back from break. Well, Heidi, thank you again for connecting us to Dr. Zavia Carner. I just feel like it's kind of a two-for-one deal with that because we got some great arts history, but also don't forget about that history that she has too. So thanks for doing that.
Oh, it was so good to have her on.
Yeah. Speaking of history, folks, it's the part of the show that we love to showcase local Houstonians, longtime Houstonians, and people that have made an impact in our city. And when it comes to Houston radio history, when it comes to the medium itself, when it comes to actually, you know, we're celebrating Memorial Day weekend coming up here, and a veteran himself that he is. We're going to talk about all that and so much more with the one and only Dave Ritz. Dave Ritz, welcome to the Houston Hour.
It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you home because most people cannot say they actually were on the KPFT airwaves in our old downtown building, the beautiful Atlantic Life building back in the day, but you actually broadcasted out of that building.
Yes, I did. When I first came to Houston, I had time before I had to go to U of H to go to school. So I ran down to KPFT and checked out what they were doing. A whole different world than the current KPFT. They played a lot of classical. They played Russian beer music. It was just
Russian beer music.
Oh,
wow.
Lisa Lott, I think was her name. They had a much stronger gay spot online than they currently do. They had several male gay shows, and they had lesbian shows, and they actually had one about underage children show, which was kind of weird.
What year would this have been?
72.
Yeah, this would have been 72.
Yeah. Hmm. We got Pride Month coming up right on the corner, and we've got some really great guests coming on that have got a KPFT history connection that are part of the LGBTQ+.
We
so
do.
Listeners out there, if you're listening right now, we got a whole month curated of important guests in the LGBTQ+ community happening next week, starting out with J.D. Doyle and Alton Delaney. So those are really two exciting guests that are coming up. But I love the idea of that being part of the history because I didn't know that. And you don't find those kind of things out unless you interview and talk to folks that have come before
us. They were actually there.
That's a rare rarity. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's wonderful. And your background, besides KPFT, goes a little further back, right? Because you had the pleasure of being on air in another country.
I did.
Tell listeners about that.
I was drafted, and I got sent around to various courses and ended up as a medic in Vietnam. I went to work there and did that for a couple of months, and then I transferred to the station in Saigon, where I was able to be on the air. I was the only person that could play album rock, and that was great. I liked that.
And what kind of albums were you playing? Were they the ones that were current?
They were not the ones that were sent. All the music you played was provided by the military. And what they would do is they'd find a record that was viable. They'd take one cut from it. So you might get Jethro Tull, and then you're going to get Lawrence Welk on the next cut.
Oh.
Since they went through multiple generations to get to the pressing, they sounded like crap. So I went to the black market downtown in Saigon and built up a collection and was working off of those. But you know, it's a pretty rocky show.
I would just like to say for our listeners, I feel like you're in the jungle of Vietnam with that shirt on.
It's a compliment.
Dave is wearing the most awesome shirt. I happen to be sitting across from him. And I can tell that someone who loves you made it for you for these reasons. One, it's awesome. Two, it fits beautifully. Three, she lined up those lizards so that even though the buttons and the pocket and everything, the pattern lines up, you wouldn't get that in a mass-produced shirt.
No,
it's really
too
well.
Much work.
It's really well. So did you spend time in the jungle in Vietnam before you were behind the...
And how do you look at the buttons?
What's going on with the buttons?
What do we got here? We got leaves.
Oh, I didn't even see the leaf buttons.
Yes.
Holy cow. I'm just noting there's a beautiful lizard right across your chest, and it's all lined up even though it buttons there.
And she it's fitted perfectly. It's really
painstakingly
it's
matched
a custom
that
shirt.
Design. Yeah. But did you spend some time in the jungle in Vietnam?
No, I didn't. I was in a hospital. Think of MASH. It was like a MASH. And then I went to Saigon, and that really opened my mind. My dad was a meat and potatoes guy, and I found French cooking, and I found Asian cooking.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was a real growth thing for me.
Had you traveled before that?
A lot in America, but I had not been overseas. I made up for that later, but...
Well, and you went someplace that was so different from, I would imagine, where you're from.
Yes, but that was perfectly okay. You know, new experiences give you better understanding of life and how you fit into your life and what other societies and countries are like. It's important.
I agree. Yeah. I've lived abroad years myself, but never in a war. So we're glad that you did that. Thank you for your service.
Sure.
Yeah. Now is the time, especially this weekend, to reflect on that and make sure people realize that folks like yourselves and other folks, too, that have just made that ultimate sacrifice and in a place. And very few folks can now say they were in Vietnam. They were part of that aspect of our American and world history. So like Heidi said, definitely thank you for your service on that. And I can't help but to think about, I mean, you mentioned MASH a second ago, but Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams. I mean, here you are, you're on the radio, you're making an impact by promoting American culture throughout the Vietnam area, but also for our soldiers. That was a big morale booster for a lot of them to be able to
hear
something from home, which they were certainly yearning for a little bit of home.
Yes, that was a very, very popular thing with the show I was playing. I was getting a lot of mail from people in the field and people in other spots of the country. And the signal was so strong that my show on the AM, I got letters from Sweden.
Oh my goodness, you're kidding.
Which is amazing.
Oh, wow.
That's halfway around the globe.
Wow.
But that's the power of radio.
It is indeed.
Wow. Yeah. That's really saying something.
Absolutely. So after when you come to KPFT, then you actually had the pleasure of working for a really important radio station in our market. It's our NPR affiliate here in the Houston area. The TV side of this has been around since 1953, but the radio side goes back a little earlier. You were actually the program director for this very prestigious radio station that we also share the airwaves with. Let listeners know where you'd go on to.
Yes, after I started school back there again, I went to KUHF. And I started there as music director and then became program director. And at that time, the music they were playing was banal. I would say that's about right. It was easy listening. And so we started playing jazz and we started playing blues and R&B. So it started growing and growing. And as we were able to move up on the 1,000-foot tower, all of a sudden the city could hear us everywhere. And we were starting to compete with the main stations in town for listeners, which was amazing.
That is a big deal. And what was Houston like back in that time period, the early to mid-70s, especially the U of H area? But what were things like back then in the Houston area?
Well, it was the period of time when you still had hippies. So there was a lot of drugs, which is part of that time.
Sure.
A lot of great music, a lot of good venues.
Which is probably because of the drugs and the writers, right? I mean, they're being influenced by some of these.
Yes, Absolutely.
It's true. I mean, some of the best songs.
As long as it didn't take them over and destroy them. With some bands, that happened.
That did happen, actually. Yes, absolutely. But now, do you remember the Market Square area of Houston and downtown? Kind of being an area?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about any fun nightclubs or places that you might have gone to or places that you might remember back in the Market Square area.
Well, there was a jazz venue down there called La Bastille.
Yeah.
And God, they had the best jazz artists on the planet. It was amazing. Thelonious Monk.
Wow.
Weather Report.
Wow.
People I never thought I'd see, and not only I get to see them, but I got to meet them, and, you know, I actually made some friends there. That was, I spent a lot of time there.
The Allen's Landing area, this is a little bit after David Addix's Love Street Feel Good Light Circus Machine.
Yeah, but that was a good venue.
Did you go to that?
No, it was before my time.
Okay.
I was in Denver, so I went to the Family Dog in Denver.
Oh,
the equivalent.
I see, yeah.
Yeah, he did it in 67, and it was starting to peter out towards the end, but it's just an example of, wow.
He came on the show and talked about that and about people like laying on the floor looking at lights and stuff.
Yeah,
yes, that's part of the time.
Yeah, mattresses and lava lamps and all that kind of stuff. You're absolutely right, part of the time. And you were in a city of tremendous growth at that particular time period. You can look at our skyline in the mid-70s and see the Pennzoil building being constructed and completed in 76, and you can see other structures started to kind of take shape. So it was a city on growth. Our freeways were continuously being expanded and evaluated, so you just kind of see that happen as well. Now, you had a business in the Lower Westheimer era, we call it now. It was definitely a business that I can imagine every young person wanting to go to, and kind of something that people did back then was they actually shop for these things in store. Let listeners know what kind of shop you had.
It was a music shop. We sold records. It was called Infinite Records. That made sense. We had started at the Common Market, selling records there.
And where was the Common Market again? Tell
that
us.
That was out 59, just past 610.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there.
Yeah.
And first, I started with two boxes of records, and within a few months, I had two booths and was just cranking out the money. It was doing well, and that gave us the capital we needed to go and open the record store. The record store was my best friend and my worst enemy.
Oh, you got to explain that one.
Well, Lower Westheimer at that time, there was a lot of prostitution, a lot of drug addiction.
Is this the late 70s, early 80s? Give us a time period.
We're talking late 70s, beginning of the 80s.
Yeah.
That's when it happened. So there was a lot of problems that you had down there. People would break in. They were looking to get some money. They're high. What else are they going to do? And it grew so fast that it was just frightening. It was the point where I was going to England once a month to pick up products.
You're kidding.
I was doing business with all of the major labels, and we had teams that were working colleges all over the South selling posters.
Wow.
And we were doing record conventions as far away as Tennessee and Minnesota on a monthly basis. So, and concert promotion with Tom Bunch, who was a real pioneer, and you should consider talking to him.
Let's get him on the show. No, that's so important. We want to capture, this is an oral history more than anything else. We tell listeners all the time, this is why KPFT matters and why the Houston Hour matters and why your time and your expertise and your history is so special to get out there to the audience, the public. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, Tom Bunch started producing shows. I had already known him when I was working for one of the record labels. I would meet him at his record store, and he'd buy stuff out of my trunk. And he went on to start promoting shows, and he was doing a lot of shows. Had several clubs up on Washington Avenue and was doing Coliseum even stuff. And I got in with him at some point and started to help him monetarily get the front capital needed. And sometimes that worked out, and sometimes that didn't work out. We had one time when we were doing a show, Cardi's, I think, was the venue, with the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Wow, early on, kidding.
For them.
Wow.
So we're both there, and the crowds are coming in, and it's good. And the way it works, you pay 50% up front before they show up. And then when they show up, you pay the other half in cash because everybody's buying tickets at the window. And, well, he went outside and decided to smoke a he decided to have a smoke. Let's just leave it at that.
Sure, yeah.
And the police came by, and they arrested him, and he had the other half of the money. So the Red Hot Chili Peppers are waiting to get paid, and I had to go backstage and work it out. And
oh, my God.
They were really good about it. And we had another show the next day at the Ritz. Nothing. Not the same venue. But,
yeah, different, yeah.
So, and he got out, and it was all good. Ups and downs. That led me, not because I didn't have enough on my plate, it got me to produce a production company. And we started doing 3- and 4-camera live venue recordings and mixing them on site. So we were doing a lot of punk stuff and even some bigger acts.
And by recordings, you mean audio?
We were doing it on U-matic videotape.
Wow.
Since we were mixing them at the time, basically all we had to do was credits front, credits back. And a lot of that has been used over the years. Dead Kennedys called me. They wanted to use it.
Oh, cool.
Sure. Yeah,
cool,
no problem. That was just another aspect. I might mention the record industry at that time, and probably today, was very crooked. Mm-hmm. So,
and explain, because you and I talked about this when we had lunch, but just tell listeners a little bit about how that process worked. And now that industry, well, maybe it's still the way it is, but back then it was different.
It has changed. They had to promote the records at the radio station. That means they had to get the program director to agree to play whatever song, whether it was good or bad. And one of the things they used that was very popular was cocaine. Now, they had to come up with the money for that. And except for Island Records, they would actually send their promos to their employees with coke and in the
wow.
package.
Mm-hmm. Is this the industry? The thing called payola, is this what this is?
It has a lot of elements to that. There uh-huh. was a gentleman here in town who worked with 30 stations, and he basically told them what to play. And they'd say, okay, and he'd say, okay, the check's in the mail.
And that's powerful. That means you're playing this song, the kids are listening to it, they're buying those, they're requesting those records, they're
right.
buying them. I mean, that's a lot of power. This is, for young people listening out there, this is way before any kind of internet, way before any kind of TV's there, but it's not the same, used the same way as before MTV. It's a situation where when you tell someone to do something, the masses kind of listen.
Well, yes. And so the way they structured that is they had to find money to make this all possible. So one of the ways they would do that is by getting rid of promos, and I ended up buying about 5,000 pieces a month from various major record companies. And of course, that money was then being converted to payola or to drugs or to whatever, and it was all coming out of the artist's pocket. It was just...
So the artist didn't know they were getting fleeced the way they were getting fleeced.
Hosed is the way I describe
it. The same thing. Yeah, there you go. It's a little stronger, but you're right.
So it got to the point where we were moving about 5,000 records a week out of that 1,200 square foot store. And
what?
Oh, yeah. It was just, it was frightening.
Oh, my goodness.
And it got to the point, I had a guy that was Capitol Records, and he handled posters, promo posters. And he'd call me up and he'd say, hey, we're going to not make any more Dark Side of the Moon posters. Do you want any more? And I'd say, yeah, send me 250. And that money was just going into his pocket and being spent on drugs.
Wow.
The good and bad side of the music. Frank Zappa said early on that the music business has two aspects. And one is music. The other is business. And that's the way it was structured.
Wow. And look at how much it's changed with download and stream and all that stuff. It's
absolutely
very hard to control what's happening and all that.
And you're still part of that industry, too, because you're still part of the record world because you're actually selling vinyl at different events, right, every now and then?
Yes, we do record shows every other month in Houston.
Which is popular.
Where do you do that?
GSH Event Center. And that is just south of 59 and just inside the Beltway. Big, beautiful place. It is. It's perfect. But we got folks that come from all over the South, and all kinds of music are there, and memorabilia. And seems to be a lot of interest in old T-shirts. So I dug a bunch of those out, old KPF T-shirts.
Those are valuable.
Yeah.
I
yep.
mean, just because of the fabrics they use, but also just the graphics and logos that you can never find anywhere else, and no one's printing those things anymore. So
true.
You're right. Those are valuable. They're part of nostalgic. Some people even frame those stuff for their man caves or for their offices. So lots
sure.
of great memorabilia. And I just love the idea of you still doing that. So people can go out there and buy a little piece of history. And the great thing about records is you've got the liner notes, you've also got the ability to play them if you want. So you can collect it because you collect them, or you can collect them and listen to them. So it's just a fun little piece of history.
I do hope that they play them, though. That's the best part. Let it touch their heart and their soul.
Yeah.
And move them.
We can all three of us agree, listening to a record sometimes with the popping and the cracking and just the way that it is very different than hearing a digitally mastered copy of it, which is still nice for some areas, but the record really is a special art form.
Well, there was such a joy to going to the record store, taking all the time in the world to flip through, read this stuff, and then when you pick what you wanted, it was so exciting. And you'd go home and you'd open it up, and I had headphones, and there were records where it would go from one ear to the other, and reading the liner notes while you're listening to the album, not doing anything but that. And it was just such a very special moment. I can remember listening to like Frampton Comes Alive like that. And it was such a joyful, cool experience and really very relaxing.
It is.
Yeah.
It is, and it was. And the liner notes, big pictures, you know, you got art, you got little booklets inside, and you had something to hold on to while you were reading. So I'm not trying to bash CDs or cassettes at the time. cassettes were more disposable and not made to have the longevity that the records were having.
Yeah, they're disintegrating, but compact.
And you handled the record with such care, and maybe you had a thing to wipe it before you placed it down, and you put it carefully back in the shelf or whatever. That's just a thing that was part of it, sort of like a tea ritual or something if you're making a tea for someone.
I agree. It was a very personalized thing, and you shared it to your friends. You'd take them to the party. Mm-hmm. You'd bring your records to the party that are moving you, and you'd hear those, and you'd hear the other people at the party saying, this is an album I like, and playing a little of that.
When I was a young person, I was a big babysitter, and I used to convert everything I did into records. So it was like, how much would I have to babysit to get that? And I started buying 45s, and then when I got real money, I could buy albums. And then when I got serious money, I could buy a double album, you know, and it was just really fun and just a huge part of my childhood.
Well, I have to make a confession. My interest in getting into radio was not predicated by being on radio. It was about getting free records.
Oh.
I have to confess.
Sure. That was smart.
Thousands of albums have passed through my hands over that time.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Also, in that same time, I was such a huge fan of radio. It was when the DJs, unlike the ones getting paid to play songs, you know, chose what they wanted to listen to, and they had a real signature, which was their taste in music, and you would listen to a certain DJ or just someone because they were funny or whatever. It was such a big part of our culture. I used to have a radio that I carried with me everywhere I went. I had one that fit on my bike. It clipped on. It was in the shape of a donut, and I used to clip it onto my handlebars, and I was always listening to it.
I think that was fairly standard.
Yeah, I do too.
When I was programming in Grand Junction early on, one time I played an album by a band called Poco. It was their first band, and it was a pretty good record. And about 30 minutes later, I got a call from them, and they were on their way to Denver to do their first show in Denver, and they came by, and
wow.
I'm not going to say there were any drugs involved, but there might have been.
And now, besides records and radio, you actually still do this now professionally. It's a very Texas kind of thing, the industry to be involved in. Let us just know what you're doing now.
Yeah, I have a small oil company. We evolved a technology that's come out of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and evolved to the point where we can go across the land and predetermine with a high degree of success whether there's oil or gas there. And it's kind of interesting because it's a radioactive unit, but it's not radioactive. It measures the radioactive particles from the core of the Earth, and as it passes, it changes them a little bit. So it measures those differences.
Wow.
So,
well, that's amazing. And let listeners know about your record shop. Where was it located again?
A 528 Westheimer.
And what's there now?
There is a very nice little restaurant there. Tore down my two-story brick building that I own, but that's okay.
You know, it happens, though. And also, you and I chatted over lunch about just some fun Lower Westheimer festivals and events that happened. They were good and bad, good for the visibility, but a lot of people there. What were those like?
Those were crazy. They were mayhem. We would always put a bunch of $1 or $2 records out front. We would have a band to play. And
in front of your shop?
In front of the shop.
Yeah.
And there'd be thousands of people there. I always enjoyed that. It was a bitch cleaning up. Let's put it that way afterwards.
But a cool thing to do.
But a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
And while we're talking about locations, any memories of the old Atlantic Life building where KPFT was founded? There's just very few people that have actually been inside that space. For context, listeners, this is physically where Beer Paredes is located now in downtown Houston.
Yes.
Yeah, right there off of Prairie and Louisiana Street. The Atlantic Life building, I believe, was a three-story brick building. And what floor was KPFT on? Remind us.
Second floor.
On the second floor. This is at the time for listeners out there and for KPFT loyalists to know. And remember that this was a time when the KKK famously bombed the transmitter out there to try to get us off the air. It might have happened a little bit after you were there, but...
No, a little before. They had the wreckage in the station for a lot of years.
Yeah, we still have the wreckage in the station, but
I know.
I mean, it's just so cool. We have a little bit of KPFT history that's at the station so people can see that. It's just a reminder of the power of radio and the fact that free speech is still alive and well and important for all of us. And the importance of giving to KPFT too, you know, as we close out our current drive, we remind people to make sure the month of May closes out to please consider giving to KPFT, not just for stories like the one that Dave is telling us now to bring you that kind of programming, but it really does matter. Any pitch you have for listeners to give to KPFT, why should they do that?
I'll tell you why. They play the most diverse selection of music. They have a lot of audio shows. People talk about important issues. And they play the stuff that nobody else will play, and they play it well.
Yeah.
And I like the variety of different programming that they have and have had over the years. It has changed some, a long way from classical, but that's okay.
It's curated, which means that these folks that are putting on these shows, we all know Rourke, we all love and adore Rourke and R&R, and these shows that are happening on a daily basis at Susan Darrow, those are people that understand music, love music as much as everybody does listening as well, and they work hard. Boy, they've got, you know, these premium gifts that we offer when people contribute. So kpft.org, hit the donation button, folks, and then you can make a contribution in any amount. We don't care whether it's $10, $5, $25 to become a member, or if you want to get some of those premium prizes. I mean, $100 is something that not everybody can do, but those that can do that, we do ask that they do that, only because it's going to really make a big difference. And make sure you do it under the Houston Hour, folks. When you
Please.
Go to the, yeah, right, Heidi? Because we've got awesome listeners that do give, but they give overall to KPFT. And if you do it under the Houston Hour name, we certainly get credit as a show. And the money all goes to KPFT, but it's the concept of making sure that you let us know and our station heads know that this show matters.
I give a little bit every day, and I think it's a really easy way to give.
It's easy to do. You can set up different ways. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, you give a little every day. You also have your time. You're putting your time in, which is an important thing.
It sure is.
A lot of volunteers spend a lot of their time. They really deserve the accolades for helping to raise the capital to keep KPFT going.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that matters.
KPFT is important. There's not a lot of good music channels in this market.
And channels that give a voice to all the community, so that really matters. As a longtime Houstonian, we like to ask you, what is something gone from Houston, something that you miss from Houston's landscape that is gone?
There was a comedy club at a hotel out toward the Astrodome, and it's completely ignored, but a lot of the records that were made in the 60s were recorded there. There's a Smothers Brothers Live from a club in California. That's a lie. That was recorded at the Trade Winds Hotel.
Gee.
And, you know, much like other venues bring in different types of music, they were bringing in the best of the best.
Tidelands Inn or Tradewinds?
Tidelands Inn.
Yeah, the old Tidelands
Inn. I haven't been down there in a long time.
For context, folks, this is basically on the corner of University Boulevard and South Main or Main Street. It's just right by the Rice campus. But the Tidelands Inn was a big deal back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and so forth. And it was demolished later on. There is a current Baylor College of Medicine building / Rice University Campus Partnership building, I believe, on that property. But it is the southwest corner of University and Main Street, across from the old Yale College. Used to be back in the day, and Christie's Seafood and places like that, the earlier Christie's Seafood location,
right.
Not the current one on Westheimer, but lots of history all around. And Dave, thank you so much for sharing it with us. Before we leave, I want to thank you again for being on the show. Anything else? Give people your email address before we leave, a way they can get a hold of you in case they have any questions or want to connect with you.
I've got an email address. It's very simple. imdritz@gmail.com.
You certainly are. I love that.
I started early. The only way you could get one like that is when you had to start when they were just starting to do that.
Oh, you saw the writing on the wall. See? Well, thank
A+.
You again, Dave, for joining Heidi Vaughn and Mr. McKinney on the Houston Hour. We are now going to hand it over. Take care, Houston.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits. Putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts. Putting on the Ritz. Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air?
You've been listening to the Houston Hour with Mr. McKinney and Heidi Vaughn. Tune in right here on 90.1 FM KPFT. Stay connected with us on Facebook and Instagram at The Houston Hour and on Twitter at the HOU Hour and the number 1. We always welcome show ideas and listener feedback at thehoustonhour@gmail.com. And you can listen to this show and past archived shows at kpft.org. Till next week, Houston.
Fun drive again. Three words familiar to anyone who knows the great programming that you hear on KPFT, because our community, you, keep it alive. That's why Houston's community station is an icon in the most diverse city in the nation, a city with a staggering mix of cultures, opinions, and tastes, and only KPFT Houston can meet those needs. Whether it's music played only here, human interest stories that stretch the boundaries of our arts, and talk, which is hardly cheap. You'll hear it only on 90.1 KPFT Houston's community station. Only you can keep us going. That's the power of corporate-free, listener-sponsored radio. More important, it's the power you have in choosing the programs you want. When you call 713-526-5738 option 1 or kpft.org, then go to donations and give us what you can. KPFT Houston, 713-526-5738. Don't forget, because we'll never forget you. Peace.
Hi, I'm Matt Harlan from right here in Houston, Texas. KPFT, a special radio station. When I moved here, put it on the dial, and I don't think I've ever taken it off. 15 or so years I've been around. At its essence, it's the community that helps all of us, musicians, music venues, everybody involved in the industry, talk to each other, promote each other, support each other. That's what Houston has always meant to me, and KPFT is pretty much the radio embodiment of what I think the Houston music community is. We would be lost without them. So hope you keep listening, donate, support. You'll hear us sometime soon.